Alright guys, what's up? Welcome to episode 6 of Storytime with Tofu. I guess I was supposed to stop saying the numbers, but maybe when we hit double digits. But anyway, that was Cliff Martinez's score to The Nick. I don't know if you guys are watching that. I hope so, because I talk about it a lot. But I understand not everyone has Cinemax, and not everyone is willing to pirate. I didn't say that. Regardless, before we step more into the wonderful score of The Nick, The Leftovers, as well as awesome things about Fargo, I do want to give a very special honorable mention to Supergirl on this podcast before we do comic book podcast involving Arrow and The Flash on the CW, mostly because Supergirl was actually on CBS, premiered last night, actually right after Monday Night Football, so honestly a really interesting time slot in my mind, but I'm not a huge sports buff, so I digress. But anyway, I also apologize. I'm a little bit under the weather. So if you hear wheezing and if you see weird pauses in this podcast, it's because I'm probably coughing uncontrollably. But anyway, hopefully we can get through this and you can understand exactly what I'm saying. But anyway, Supergirl, starring Melissa Benoist of Glee. I really hope that's how you say her name. No, it's not. It's not Benoist. No, there's no T in that. Anyway, Melissa Benoist is the star of this show. She's not rocking her brunette, like, weird bangy self. She's got some nice blonde locks going and has a much more, like, full-bodied head of hair. Wow, I just went really detailed into, like, women's hairstyle. Not important. Sorry. But anyway, I was, like, very much certain when they announced this show that this was going to be absolutely terrible. Mostly because I hate CBS, because they do things like NCIS, Two and a Half Men, freaking Scorpion, which I can't stand. The only good show I think I like is The Good Wife. And despite being from Hawaii, I hate Hawaii Five-0. I'm glad it's on, but screw that show. Anyway, why Supergirl was so surprising is I, and as you've heard, I've been super behind the entire like CW operation. They're creating their own mythos, really now taking the step forward into creating their own comic book lore universe for their series, for their network. And so when I found out, I forget his last name, but Greg, one of the executive producers and writers for the Arrow and Flash, and I guess this now CW-DC universe creation of the CWs, he did apparently have a hand in creating and writing this version of Supergirl. And that, honestly, was the most off-putting to me. Not because I don't like him, it's just because, like, this character is not supposed to fit into the universe of the DC comic book superheroes that the CW have created. And so I thought, honestly, I thought they were going to step too far and still try and tackle a CW audience. I mean, not a CW, a CBS more generic audience. And it was just going to be awful. I don't know if changes were made from when the actual pilot was released, I believe about 4 months ago, to previews that were just... I think the only good review of those early screeners I read was on Kotaku. And I don't even want to explain what Kotaku is right now, so I'm not going to. But I was very shockingly surprised by how well put together the series seemingly is from the pilot, how charmed I am by the leading actress, impressed I am by character choices as well as plot development choices, and not just being overly generic in terms of, like, Supergirl, her best friend is a boy who she can confide in, blah, blah, blah. Like, if they did that, I swear to God I was going to punch someone in the face. Like, not that there's anything wrong with that, but we get so much of that. Like, that's what fucking Arrow and The Flash is right now. Not all the time, but that is somewhat of the dynamic once in a while. Like, Oliver, you're so dark and you do so much, but I just want to be there for you. No, okay, so dumb. Anyway, you know, they gave her her own character. And I think the best phrase I could give about Supergirl right now is that comic book series, because I feel like there's so much weight, so much history, so much expectation behind it, tends to try really, really hard. And you see this in and out of Arrow season 1 on the CW, which is not a perfect season. It had issues. But you actually, I didn't get any of that from Supergirl. I didn't get, like, oh, we're trying to create this very dark, like, superhero with lots of mythos and mystery and lore, and we're trying to please everybody while create some really dark, fascinating storyline. And again, the CW does not do that completely. Although they do have you ogling over some very, very handsomely jawed men, it isn't all darkness, but this show is like 10 steps lighter than both, even The Flash, which I think is a pretty light show. This just has such a different rhythm and beat to it, and I'm actually very, very impressed about how self-aware the series was. There were jokes about midriff, because Supergirl's original costume, I think, was supposed to have midriff. There are jokes about, I guess not really a joke, it's a legit observation. Supergirl? Like, why is she called Supergirl? I mean, shouldn't she be called, like, Superwoman? And they have that whole debate. More importantly, this is the first time I've honestly felt a lot of girl power emanating from every essence of the series. The 100 puts on a good front of girl power, but by the end of it, there's a pretty even mix of both, although I do like that Octavia and Clark are the two strong female leads of that. But again, I was really impressed by the choice not to give Supergirl an immediate love interest. They've planted seeds, but there's no, like, secret best friend who's in love with you, or, you know, you have an older brother that you can always rely on. Because I feel like a lot of times, even strong female characters are given those, like, weird, you know, not unnecessary, but often overused side characters. I thought there was going to be too much Superman in this, you know, introductory series. And so far, they've honestly made him kind of like a shadow. Like a shadow, because he has no lines. He's always spoken of like, you know, like, oh, where's Superman? What is he doing? What does he have planned for me? And we don't see his face, and we barely see him, which is so necessary. Because the way they've changed Supergirl's character, they've made her a little more passive, not very cocky or overly confident, which is very different from the Supergirl I know. So that's why at first, again, I was a little like, oh, who is this like klutzy, you know, not badass, you know, grabbing Galatea by the chest and socking her in the face 6 times. But, you know, these things take time. You know, I'm really glad they chose to have her not come at age 15 or 16. They had her land at like 12 or 10, because it gives her time. It gives us an unbelievable amount of time, as well as it gives the writers a lot more leeway to legitimately change her character. This girl arguably is a lot more likable than for America, at least, than I would assume. I think Adrian Pilecki was supposed to do a Wonder Woman potential series like 4 years ago, right when she was hot off of Friday Night Lights. But yeah, I think that would have been a series that I would have described as, this is okay, but it's trying so hard. You know, it's trying... And again, this show is just so light, it's easy to get through, and I don't finish the episode saying, God, this was stupid, B, I hate Supergirl, or B, like, they've ruined Supergirl for me. They haven't. They've given me something interesting. I'm curious to see my relationship develop with it. I'm curious to see how America responds to it, and I'm also curious to see how more of television critic America responds to it. I don't listen to comic book fans very loudly anymore, because we're just way too opinionated at times, but television critics, I am curious about, because they can put the lens of like the industry of television on. If you want a really good read on this, I'm gonna try writing an article today, but I'm a terrible writer, so it probably won't happen. But 4 days ago, Vulture released an article. I think it's titled "Supergirl is Smart and is Feminist, and this is why a lot of people won't watch it." Terrible title. But it does highlight the things the show does incredibly well, as well as pointing out why they're kind of newer and necessary in this landscape, and why, you know, why we should watch it anyway. If you like Supergirl and you're a hardcore comic book fan, and you can't, like, put a different helmet on when you're watching this show, don't watch it. It's a waste of your time. You won't like it. If you're a TV fan, you like superheroes, you like... like, just charming, cute leads who are honestly all very endearing, and again, are not trying so hard, are just bubbly, warm, they hit all of their beats, and the story flew very nicely. I didn't feel, like, bogged down at any points. Wow, excuse me. But before I ramble on about Supergirl for another 20 minutes, because I'll probably start talking about like Justice League Unlimited or something, let's completely switch gears, and I'll make sure to add like a timestamp or whatever. 10 minutes is when we start quality TV talk. And it's hard, because this week everything was friggin' awesome, but let's just start with the Nick, because it comes out on Fridays. It technically aired, I think, almost like 4 or 5 days ago already, so we should talk about that. The Nick, again, this is only episode 2 of season 2, and it is by far so fascinating. It is a show full of both rich symbolism, thematicism, and it's just shot so interestingly that, like, all both those sentiments of, like, symbols, themes, and just emotional, just trying to convey emotions through unconventional means so you think about them differently. Steven Soderbergh takes the cap. Cliff Martinez takes the cap. But more importantly, I've talked about a lot of that on previous podcasts. What I want to talk about on this one is, God, this show just spits in the face of modernity so well. Okay, what are we talking about most? Maybe this is on Facebook too often or in the media. We're talking about class struggle. We're talking about religious freedom, you know, the right to get in, you know, the right to choose, which I believe in. You know, we're talking about, you know, we still talk about addiction and drugs and how they're still just plague our society and are still not something that the general media, you know, can really talk about. Another thing, racism, same thing. Systemic issues, and most importantly, the wealth gap. Okay, these are all issues in 2015. It is October 27th, 2015. And although I'm a very lucky and privileged lad who did not have to deal with a ton of adversity around these subjects growing up, this is something that is still very much discussed, very much debated, and has still not been agreed upon in this country. So, class issues, religious freedom, I mean, we talk about that, you hear about that every day in 2015. We're going back now to the Knickerbocker Hotel. This is now 1901 New York. And it's shocking how different it is, yet at the same time, nothing has changed. This episode was great. It started off with Thackeray coming back from his stint at what at the time was considered a rehab clinic, which is honestly just a place for rich people, doctors to scam rich people and test, you know, their weird psych experiments on them. Just for context, this is a time when mental health was not understood. In season 1, a very lovely, nice character, all of her teeth are removed because that was a common practice at the time. The brain is getting sick. And, you know, bacteria, germs, these all cause the infection. And if we can just find the root of where the infection is coming. So, you know, we take all precautions, like scrubbing the gums clean of all bacteria. It's horrifying. Thank God the character is no longer there. But he still has to prove himself to the hospital. He has to still deal with his own depression. But what was most fascinating about the first couple of scenes of this episode was the boardroom meeting where they're discussing, literally discussing addiction in the most the most detached way possible. And it is literally like possibly watching, you know, it's, you know, maybe not exactly 2015, but something, you know, a meeting in the 2000s about, you know, how we should deal with how to treat, you know, state-supported treatment for addicts, county-supported treatment for addicts, how do you get people the help they need, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the quote that took the cherry was definitely when Thack was like, I need to cure addiction. And everyone in the hospital was like, how is that supposed to make us money? And I'm just like, oh my God, nothing has changed. There's a nun on trial for performing abortions. And again, I'm really glad that, you know, in a lot of states in this country, a woman can legally and safely, you know, have access to an abortion. But again, there are a lot of people in this country working against that very principle. And that's insane. This show is 100 years ago, and this woman is in jail for performing abortions, you know, safe abortions for women who need them. And I'm watching these scenes where they're talking about it. I'm just like, nothing has changed. So much has changed. And finding the contrast and the comparisons and watch them intermingle, overlay, and fight each other and come together on this show is what makes it so good. So, like, I don't want to take my eyes away. It's, I have to be honest with you, it's not as enjoyable. I like to think of Mad Men, probably, other than this, one of the best period shows ever made on television, in what it had to say with every episode, every season, every arc, and literally every shot in an episode. But the nice thing about Mad Men is it was kind of more of an enjoyable ride. Like, kind of picture you're on a slow paddle boat, and you're kind of going through this very long river of scenes, and you just get to look and observe, and, you know, you're never always in the scene with the characters, but you have such a multidimensional perspective on it that watching Mad Men, you can watch it over and over again, and you will find more and more things about it. But it goes at a very easy, and possibly because it has so much content to offer, it goes at a very easy, easy pace. The Nick won't offer that. And you can tell from the soundtrack, like, dun, 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 and, like, all the variants in, like, the time signatures of this, the music he uses is not supposed to let you sit comfortably in your seat like that and watch people. It's supposed to shove you in the room with them, okay? When Juliet Rylance's character is, excuse me. When Juliet Rylance's character is sitting in a room with her husband and her father-in-law discussing, you know, what a woman's role in a family is. I mean, Steven Soderbergh could easily just use, like, oh, medium shot here, medium shot here, medium shot here, close up there, build tension. Instead, he uses this, like, very odd, like, I don't even know what angle it is, but it's a medium shot of all three of them, but from a very, very, like, kind of fly in the wall kind of angle. Yet at the same time, it makes you get inside Juliet Rylance's head so much more. Maybe it's because the other two characters are very dirty in the shot when we finally get the nice sweep that's, like, kind of coming up from under her chin, just straight on her face. But, like, it's hard when a show gets you thinking this much, because at the same time you're like, shit, is everyone else looking at this, or is this just my, you know, mad ravings? But I think it's super important, and it's incredibly fascinating that a show like The Nick can have so much to say about today when there is barely electricity in the world. I think another great metaphor from this past episode is one of the side characters, Cleary, who's an ambulance driver, acquires an automobile. Again, 1901, so I don't think automobiles were relatively standard everywhere until the late teens, maybe the 20s. Remember, we went into World War I with a lot of horses. But, like, he's trying to incorporate this. It's supposed to bring this grand new technology to this hospital, a field that is almost dependent on, if not solely reliant on, progress, technology, and again, modernity. It's the friggin' 20th century, right? And it does not work. There's a scene where a wheel breaks, it hits a woman in the face, so it not only they have to give up their patient, they've caused another one, and they can't even take her to the hospital because the car won't be fixed. There's a scene where he has to pick someone up and the battery died because of the cold. It's just, like, such a perfect metaphor for just how hard progress is. It's so easy to say, you know, oh, once a leap and bound is made, it may have taken an arm and a leg to get there. But implementing it should be something straightforward. We learn about it, we do it, we execute it. Unfortunately, logic dictates that. but reality does not. Hence, I'm pretty sure that's why we're still using standard units of measurement instead of the metric system. I'm pretty sure, maybe it was Carter. It was either Jimmy Carter or Lyndon B. Johnson. I know, very many years apart. I think who theorized trying to switch us over to the metric system and just was like, you know what, this will ruin everything. Let's just keep it the same way. But, knowing how to use knowledge is knowledge and technology is arguably another great point this series brings up. Because another thing about modernity is if it's in the raw hands of greedy, callous, non-understanding people, it doesn't benefit anyone but themselves. You know, it doesn't matter if we have the cure for cancer if 90% of the world does not have access to the cure to cancer. I mean, see what I mean there? Like, with every great step forward, there are so many little steps back that could be taken. There are so many people that will not even get to touch that step forward. And, you know, that's what the NIC does so well. I wish I had a little more to say on that, and I probably would if I organized better. But regardless, switching little gears on the NIC, and kind of this would connect into how I guess we transition to The Leftovers. John Thackeray has seen the little girl he killed at the end of season one. What? Like, what a great thing to have in every scene about a man who was addicted to both cocaine and then heroin, right? And despite somehow detoxing, and the reason he did not want to detox yet clean is because he did not want to remember this girl, that he did not want to see her all the time. He forced himself to, or he, I suppose he was forced to, and after that has accepted his lot. But man, are those scenes just so heavy when he just constantly is looking up and seeing, always in the right place, always at the right time, this little girl in the white hospital outfit that he attempted to save, but through his own arrogance, could not. And honestly, that's another great thing about this season is I think the arrogance has been well distributed once more. And that meaning, like, I wrote a small BuzzFeed community post about the arrogant bastard, aka the protagonist of a lot of, like, high-end period television. You get Anson Mount, Cullen Bohannon, and Hell on Wheels. You have, you know, I don't remember the actor name, but the captain from Black Sails, both of them, just arrogant white men surviving in a world of arrogant white men where they're always right. What's nice about John Thackeray, he's no longer always right. He's learning again. He's become multidimensional again. And that is so important because I think there was a New York Times article that came out after the first two episodes of season one that was like, this show's terrible. It's not advancing anything in television. It was mostly focused on the writing, and I think she thought a lot of the characters were kind of stock and weak. But I mean, that was only episode three, and we're now two episodes into the second season, and I guarantee you the writers, the director are doing all of these characters justice. You know, it is 1901, so despite, you know, Andre Holland's character, who's like the black doctor at the NIC, I do see the complaint that there aren't a lot of other roles offered to, actors of color in the series. There's like three Chinese prostitutes and three Chinese gangsters. And then there are a lot of just black, like, stock side characters, like, anytime, you know, and it's there for a reason, but I'm saying I understand why that is a complaint about this series. Like, why do we have to watch a show about white people arrogantly doing, you know, brilliant things in a world full of white people? I get that, you know, but not every show is perfect, and all of the positives of the show definitely outweigh that. But other major developments in the NIC, really big. Oh, that's right. So Bono's daughter, I think her actress's name is Eve Hewson. She plays Nurse Elkins on the show from West Virginia, which is funny because she's Bono's daughter. But her, not her real father. Bono is not appearing in the Nick, but her father in the series is this Baptist minister from West Virginia, and that was another time when I was just like, oh my God. We still live in such a not connected world. It is significantly more connected, but it's just not. He's giving a speech about being in New York for the first time and how no matter all the strange things he's seen, he always remembers home. He always remembers the Lord, exactly. But this is the first time, other than the nun abortion side plot, that religion, I think, is going to heavily weigh into this season a lot more, because he's showing up in episode 2. This is a character who, you know, a character's father who has been wronged by Thackeray, who has now been cast aside, quote unquote, for her own good by Thackeray. And I think this is going to make her do something potentially not true to herself, which I think involves maybe getting super religious. I don't know. I'd love to see that, especially because it's Bono's daughter. Wow, I'm sorry about the coughing and wheezing, guys. I promise, hopefully in 2 days when I podcast again, it will not be like this. But, you know, other than that, the Nick is on a slow rise to epicness. My only thing about it is, it is just, I totally understand at the end of a long work day, or, you know, on a Sunday morning, Saturday morning, you do not necessarily want to watch a very dark, very kind of Freudian-esque show about 1900 gruesome surgeries, drug addiction, and overall just how life can really just be shit. There's, I think midway through season one, I was like, fuck, nothing positive is happening in the show right now. I mean, you see a man, you know, saving lives, but at the same time destroying his own and worse, the lives of other around him. So again, final montages of certain episodes are pretty just like, Jesus, why am I sitting through this? But at the same time, I think that also makes it more real for you. Excuse me. In the season premiere of 2, there's not too many surgery scenes. There's one where Thackeray is performing an illegal plastic surgery at his rehab clinic for money. For cocaine from the orderlies. But the other major surgery is when they have to cut open and drain someone's inflamed arm. And I just remember seeing the blood drain out, mostly because I had also recently just had minor surgery on my foot. Seeing the pus come out, and I was like, God, we're just gross bags of blood and liquid and ugh. Like, I'm not a squeamish person, which is why I don't mind this show, but like, when you see something like that, it instantly reminds you of what you are, you know, physically on the inside. You are a sack full of a red liquid that gives you life. And if it's fragile. You know, we're durable things, but at the same time, so many things can go wrong under that skin. And when you see a surgery performed like that on TV that's representative of the 1900s, you get very, very grateful that you live in this era right now. But at the same time, the world around us may have changed a little bit, but we're still, you know, we're still human beings. And I like that connection that the show does. But speaking of atheists, agnostics, not exactly knowing why we are all here and giving us, you know, theoretical questions as to what may be, where might be, who might be. I think it's time to talk about The Leftovers, right? Okay, we're going to talk about The Leftovers. We'll come back to The Nick. I'm excited to see more stuff coming out in episode 3 of The Nick, mostly because Juliet Rylance's subplot is getting really, really interesting to me, mostly because I like organized crime. And despite this being a show about medicine, they've done a very, very good job of intertwining organized crime. Sorry, Boardwalk Empire, which is only about that. Anyway, The Leftovers on HBO is now on episode 4. I am very, very pleased with everything that's happened, and I'm mostly very happy that we're on episode 4, because it's taken now 3 episodes to catch up with every different plot in this friggin' show. Probably because they're trying to reconstruct it. Season premiere, we are introduced to Miracle. We don't see any character we know from the first season until the end of the episode, and instead we're introduced to a new family of focus, potential ally or enemy of Justin Theroux character Kevin Garvey, the Murphys, headed by John Murphy, who is played by Kevin Coral. I don't know him. I definitely recognize his face from TV, but I don't know much about him. I'll try and do a little more research next time, maybe something interesting. And then his wife, Regina King, who, again, very popular TV actor, and I just, not popular, but definitely recognizable TV actress. And I'm sorry I can't really pinpoint her elsewhere. But episode 2, we catch up with the Garveys again. Just Kevin Garvey, so Justin Theroux's character, Carrie Coon's character, Nora, whose entire family departed, you know, before the events of the show, and their daughter, and the new adopted baby, the love child of Holy Wayne and an underage Asian girl who ran away at the end of season 1. And then episode 3, I know, I'm sorry, bear with me. Episode 3 finally catches up on Amy Brennan's character Tommy is the character's name, but Tommy and Lori, but what is the actor's name? Chris Zilka. He's in so many bad things. He's in a lot of bad teen television, so I think this is somewhat of a little bit of a attempt to break out for him, which he's, you know, he's offered us Full Frontal twice now. I've seen his package. He's trying. He also says the F word a lot, and it's really annoying. But anyway, season 1 of The Leftovers was not so different from the season that they are completely unrecognizable shows. It's more so The Leftovers season 2 is a little more self-aware about what it's potentially trying to tell us, and it's a lot more toned down on the heavy-handed nihilism. There's tons of nihilism, but, like, it's not, like, hitting you in the head with a sledgehammer, then making you try and rationalize it for 30 minutes of an episode where nothing really happens. Again, loved the first season most of the time. Was still very intrigued by it, but, again, it was incredibly off-putting to so many people, and I 100% understand why. You're like, you just see so many things in that first season, like, violence, just weird imagery that just leads nowhere. And maybe that's it obviously was intentional because someone wrote it that way, but I think they were trying to create more mysticism with the world. They didn't build it. Oh god, what is the freaking writer's name? It's Damon Lindelof, and who is the book writer who also, I'm sorry, guys. We'll look that up next time. But more importantly, it feels like the creators have reeled in the universe and are much better at leaving you clues that aren't being kind of shoved in your face really aggressively, and are kind of, it's finally giving you more space. And I think the best example of that is definitely through the new introduction. We went from a very heavy-handed orchestral scoring of agony, sorrow, and just really aggressive, like, Sistine Chapel-esque imagery of the emotions or the scenes or the, you know, the world. We were introduced to the world of The Leftovers that way, through this giant mural of, like, that almost seems a slightly bit too religious for what the show is actually trying to do. And so in the second season, you get this new intro, and again, I hope you're watching the show. It's scored by this, you know, folky, you know, 4-chord guitar songs, you know, like, where do we all come from? People know we're going and we're gonna go away. And it's like the same idea, but at a much slower pace, at a much softer tone, at a much... The Leftovers season one struggled from the fact that within an episode, you didn't have enough time to look and appreciate things. To look, explore, and embrace, all within the same amount of time as the episode, not just reflecting afterwards. Mostly because, again, some of the scenes and some of the points that season was trying to make was literally like someone shoving my head into like a friggin' drywall, like through the drywall, over and over again. Whereas this is, I literally feel like I'm sitting in a room and it's like I spy. It's like I spy and I feel like a kid again looking for things. The other thing, you know, this episode is also very indicative of is it has finally confirmed for me that we will never know what is going on. I mean, maybe if this show gets like a seventh season, we might find out, but we will never know what's going on. And we are essentially tuning in to see these people constantly struggle with that same concept. And I posted that great South Park clip about being agnostic. I think it was like, in this house, we will be agnostic. You will dress clean and appropriately. And remember, there is a God, or maybe there isn't a God. And if there is, it could also be a giant reptilian monster that lives in the sky. We may never know. And we won't, and can never know. And it's just like, that is the entire concept of this show. Because through Justin Theroux's character, Kevin Garvey, through all of the first season, there's kind of this, like, I don't want to say divine presence, but this otherworldly nature to what he is experiencing. And the only clue we kind of get of that is through his hallucinations of people that aren't there, and when he talks to his dad, who I want him to talk to more, and less scenes like in the first season where he's just like, oh, here's peanut butter and talk to me about crazy things. Like, the dad dropped one of the best hints in episode 2 of the season of like, shit's gonna go down eventually. When he said, when Justin was like, so is all that craziness behind you, you know, people talking? He was like, yes, I never said I was crazy. I mean, at the touch button, you want to do this, I can start that whole shit up again. And you're just like, what? Like, because that is a plotline from the first season that was not addressed or answered at all. Like, we now know Kevin is a sleepwalker, and we are now confirmed that he's seen Ann Dodd, Patty from The Guilty Remnant. She's also, I think she was nominated for that movie, Compliance. But she's finally talking, and she's great in this season. She's so great. She's just, her job is to literally just poke Justin Theroux in the head over and over again. Hey, I'm here. You're crazy. Can you talk to me? You should talk to me. We had a whole relationship in the previous season where I didn't say anything. So now this is me coming clean, washing all over you. And God, is it great. God, is it so awesome to literally just watch Ann Dodd just berate Justin Theroux while he's trying to do the most basic of things, like, you know, cook something, take a shower, you do laundry, and it's just horrifying. Horrifying to, like, think about experiencing. But since we're hitting the 40-minute mark, this is what I'm going to leave it at. Continue watching The Leftovers, because it's a much easier season to process. You feel more connected and actually care about the characters, which sometimes comes in and out in season one. And more importantly, there's just so much more room for it to evolve from here. We have almost three separate plot lines going on that I'm just very fascinated to see how they intertwine together. And more importantly, Amy Brennan and Ann Dodd are finally talking. There's no more long scenes in The Guilty Remnant of Liv Tyler being angry and Amy Brennan just looking at her and just not saying anything with a cigarette in her mouth. That makes the show so much easier to watch now. I promise you that. Okay, I know I said this twice now, but I'm definitely going to just leave it as, watch the, if you haven't seen The Leftovers and you're curious about season 2, we're a little put off by season 1, just take a deep breath and fast forward through what you need to of season one if you really don't want to put the time into it. And I promise you, even the scoring takes a completely different rhythm, and not tone, but definitely a different rhythm and pace for this season, to the point where it feels like they actually did hit a perfect balance between keeping what I liked about the first season as well as not changing things too much in terms of like killing off characters, just ending certain plot lines, but as well as just giving us the pace the show needed. And I'm not a Lost fan or watcher. I probably should watch it, but I am also again told that the show is a lot more Lost-like in terms of the kind of viewing experience, interactive viewing experience where you're constantly looking for things and asking yourselves questions. Well, I suppose that's the basis of existence, isn't it? And on that note, since we have 5 minutes left, and Nate and I are probably going to potentially podcast on this later today, let's talk about Fargo. This is the best show on Monday night. It's hands down the best show on Monday night. And in terms of watchability, progressiveness, and just artistry, it blows the Leftovers and the Nick, not out of the water, but to the point where it's winning the race by several lengths. You know, it's so wonderfully cast. All of the actors, from Kirsten Dunst, who a lot of people say ruined movies for them, to, you know, Jesse Plemons, Ted Danson is in this, and they're all absolutely fantastic. You know, you see characters like that, which you associate with other fictional characters, like, you know, pretty sure Ted Danson will always be friggin' Becker to me. And because they're in this less, how do I want to put that? Because they're in less of the machine of TV, you know, they're not in a network series or like, you know, a USA show. I feel like gave the actors more space and time to find these characters. And because they're being shot differently too, you know, a lot more wide shots, a ton of split screen, you know, not these generic cuts that match up to the average network beats in an episode, that brings out so much more from their performance. I have not seen Changeling. So Jeff Donovan is one of the gangster characters in the series. Forlorn Minnesota accent. I feel like they made everyone gain a little weight for this series because their faces need to be fuller for like this cold weather. But he has a range that I did not expect. I just was like, oh, Burn Notice, dude, tight. And it's like, oh, wait, you're actually really good at this. Gene Smart, another great actress, just kills it as the head of this crime family. Fargo has so many characters, and I just need to say this right now. Fargo has so many characters, so many plot devices, but it is all so wonderfully woven together. Nothing is heavy-handed. Nothing feels out of place, and you're not constantly asking yourself, why is this happening? What am I looking at? This feels so pointless. And I'm sorry, I'm literally just describing True Detective season 2 right now. And Nate, my friend Nate will back me up on this. And I said this after because last fall I marathoned both Fargo and True Detective season 1. I did not watch them when they were airing. And although I loved True Detective season 1, mostly because Matthew McConaughey is Matthew McConaughey being Matthew McConaughey, Fargo sold me. And keep in mind, like True Detective, Fargo season 1, completely different cast, completely different story. The only connection is the grandfather from season 1 is the main character in this story that is now taking place no longer in the early 2000s, but now in the mid to late 70s. And it's just incredible to me how cohesive a story they can tell, because each episode is its own art piece, from the silence in a scene that, you know, makes you feel more in the room with them, to the wonderful choices of music that are not unconventional is the wrong word, but are not standard to either the beats or even the content matter of, you know, network television. You know, you laugh, you cry, you're like bedazzled, you're wondered. And unlike the Nick and the Leftovers, you're not constantly thinking of depression. So I think I'm going to end it on that. Go watch Fargo. When episode 4 airs, I'll probably do a Nick Fargo talk instead of, you know, try and cram all three. But this is the series to be watching. This is the series that is going to rake in Emmys. And this is the series that you actually can think on in the same way you would about an episode of Mad Men, but can you know, or the Nick, but can watch actually like at night when you're a little tired, when you're not, you know, you can watch this show at the same time, in my opinion, you would watch a softer show like, you know, The Blacklist. Again, that's a terrible comparison, but like, you know, The Blacklist is a little formulaic. It's very comfortable. It's easy to sit down, get into an episode, and watch. Fargo doesn't use any of those same techniques that a show like The Blacklist does. Again, beats, etc., etc. But it is so friendly and so whimsical. I love that word. It's so whimsical for dealing with such bleak and dark events. And just uses, you know, clever, witty characters that aren't fun to just, like, kind of look embarrassed. Like, some of these characters are just like, Jesus, they're, like, not people, you know, I want to be. But it's so fascinating. And more importantly, True Detective Season 2, intertwining of plots, was a horrifying mess. Fargo has introduced almost, like, three or four different invested parties in this series. Definitely four. And we get such seamless cuts through both, even when they're doing these like nice little split screens, vertical split screens instead of horizontal. You don't feel space when you're going from scene to scene, from people to people. And more importantly, because the Fargo series kind of relies upon, you know, a crime that in which there's a law enforcement party and, you know, kind of this weird, a crime aspect, and then the bystander, the weird, how did we get caught up in this whole mess kind of characters. And I mean, honestly, there isn't a show that really has that same dynamic on television, as well as has so many multiple stories going that also cohesively come together. And I can't tell if that's reliant upon the fact that the setting is kind of small towny, or I suppose Midwest, in that towns are so sprawled, it's, you know, you have a lot of space and I guess that's indicative of how space, sound space they use in between cuts of scoring, space of silence. But I'm rambling. I'm starting to cough a lot. Thanks for listening, guys. I know I'm just talking for 50 minutes about things I like on TV, but if you guys are listening, I always appreciate it. So look forward to more Supergirl, Arrow, and Flash talks either Wednesday night or Thursday morning, and keep listening to Storytime with Tofu. Remember, I'm always watching TV with you. Peace.